If you're at any neighbourhood gathering, a barbecue or a street party or something like that that happens from time to time, there's certain topics of conversations which are really good bloke conversations, and they're generally about old power tools which you can no longer get hold of, or an old type of car that no one's ever seen, or trains, or a bit of military history. It's great bloke conversation, but it's not good general conversation. So you cut out the young people and a lot of people who don't know about the good old days, so to speak. So I'm sure that you've been around, or you may be an old bloke yourself, and you know that there's certain topics that everyone goes, oh my god, and just leaves you and a few old codgers to talk about. But there is sort of an old thing which I think people in general don't know about, and it's got a profound impact on today's civilization. And this is not, in terms of old things, this is not the atomic bomb developed by the Americans. It's something called a proximity fused artillery shell. Again, you immediately, if you're in the family zone and stuff like that, you'll immediately turn off. But please listen, because if you can put aside the gory and horrible aspects of it, it is something that was ahead of its time, had a big impact, and in world affairs, but also set America on its modern path forward. So this is a story about it. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. In this podcast, we'll talk about, throw you back into the world of early World War II. So this is the history of the Brits. Had a problem, and it's a problem which was causing them a lot of grief, and this is the Germans were firing basically what is old cruise missiles from France. They're called buzz bombs because they buzzed along, they buzzed for a certain amount of time. These are pilotless planes, almost kamikaze, so to speak, with no person on board. They buzz along, they'd fly for a certain amount of time, making a distinctive buzzing sound, buzz, and a beetle sound, a beetle bomb they used to be called, and fly along a beetle bomb alley and drop in on London. So they'd you'd hear the buzzing sound, and then be a quiet time when they'd glide down at an angle. About a ton of explosive would destroy a whole block in London. So there was, I suppose, a different sort of priority in research. So in Germany, they had to actually focus on the top things that they're going to use very quickly. In London, they had another. In England, they had reduced options. They had to really rely on the development of new technology. So radar was being developed, and this dominated the warfare to get... This is World War II, so this is Britain versus Germany at this stage. And the Germans had U-boats, which were really not... They're mostly surface boats, which go underwater for short amounts of times. And when they popped up, the British had lots of radar pointing at them. And we're going to talk about radar. So radar generally is produced by something called a magnetron. So this is high-frequency radio waves, basically microwaves. And so they go out, and they can go through the air, but they bounce off metallic things, conductors like planes or ships or little U-boats coming off. They bounce off, so they're sent out, they bounce off, and so the plane or the anything reflective looks like a radar source. So the dish which sends out the light pulse comes back again. And the timing gives a pip. So if it's very close, there's a very short pip. But if it's a long distance away, like an echo, you can basically, it's like echolocation. So it's light echolocation. And so they've developed a device which I think both sides of the both combatants had, and that was called a magnetron. And essentially this is a vacuum tube and a powerful magnetic field, and the current would actually self-interfere and create little waves, radio frequency waves, which would be coupled through devices to a rotary antenna, which would scan this radio wave or microwave radar wave source. So radar read microwave, essentially your microwave oven is a radar oven. So it was actually someone who had a chocolate bar in his lab coat and noted that when he stood in front of his radar, the actual chocolate bar became soft, and so this was followed up to form the microwave oven. So these were good land-based things, very difficult to... And the Germans eventually mounted on planes. But the more of these you had, the further and the better they went. And so the antenna would point at a particular angle on your screen. You'd have a electron gun, and it would be its deflection would be rotating, but it would be zipping back and forth, and zipping from low radius to high radius. On the timing of the radar pulses, so you wouldn't have continuous radar production. You send out a series of pings or pulses. So if you had it on all the time, it's like lighting up something with a torchlight. It would just be a light. The important thing was to have a flash, and you'd get a flash back, so to speak. And so this would mean that you could go to a certain angle, measure, have it amplified through your valves, such that your electron gun would flare up at a particular time. And this would be related to the length, and this would give a ping or a radar signature. So the British had the problem of shooting down these aircraft. They were going too low, too fast, and their anti-aircraft was knocking, say, down 1 in 50 of them, and that had a series of improvements. So one of the improvements that they got through, and this is a secondary improvement, is to remove or automate the guy on the radar screen giving out degrees to the person who's pointing the radar that have the actual, so the anti-aircraft gun, that have it automatically slaved between the two. And this was done by an early, very early form of electronic analog computer. So there'd be people solving the problem of where they thought the aircraft was in three dimensions, and actually getting the anti-aircraft gun to go and point and predict in advance. And I know only this because this was still being followed up in Australia, in the research labs in Australia, the development of these things, being a collaboration with Britain. And I heard of people who would use this to track, and they'd have drones being towed behind planes to get the anti-aircraft guns on track, and that have people actually there winding transformers, just adjusting the winds of the transformers to put it in, calibrate these automated anti-aircraft guns. So the anti-aircraft gun, that very first automation, so we've got the problem of these V1 Sikorsky V2 rockets, which have been mass-produced by Germany and been sent over and causing great destruction in London. And we've got half the solution, that is, we can actually point a cannon in the right position ahead of an object, pick up the speed, calculate the speed, and point up ahead so you can go back track, and your cannon will go to the correct place. Now, it's unlikely to actually hit the object, and it's also unlikely if you haven't got the range to actually be able to, in time, set the fuse length. So if you've got enough time, you know where the range is, you can actually set the fuse for the anti-aircraft gun to explode. And so you could mount a magnetron and some basic electronics on the top of your shell, and the shell could go forward and actually be its own little radar station. And when something became sufficiently close, it would explode. That's your proximity fuse. And there's a little bit of a story involving America and obviously the rest of World War II. So the British had some problems of miniaturizing valves, stabilizing things. Went to America, and America decided that this is something they would develop seriously, almost as seriously as the Manhattan Project. So I think the Manhattan Project was $4,000 million, and over the entire World War II and a little bit beyond, whereas this project rated as highly and was also secret, and it had annual budgets throughout the war of $100 million, $200 million. Dollars, and they basically the Americans threw everything at this invention. If they could have this, they would win the war. And so as you listen to this, we'll discuss the impact of this and how they actually won the war. Had a very big impact of it, and it's got a sort of an impact in diplomacy afterwards. So essentially, if you can fire a shell roughly, and it's got a, say, a lethal radius of 50 metres, 30 metres, to an accuracy of 20 metres, it means that you no longer have to have an accuracy of 1 metre. You can have an accuracy of 20 metres, and that will be good enough. So it's a very important development. And so the Americans, I suppose it's the scale of it to understand and how the Americans went across. So as the Germans were developing high-quality bespoke weapon systems, like the various tanks they were developing, so no tank would be, this is boring bloke story, would be interchangeable. So you had four different companies that produced the same grade of tank, the same model of tank, but none of the parts would be interchangeable. So if you bombed one section of one tank factory, you've got the other tank factories couldn't keep up. There's a whole lot of other issues, and this compared very much with the one style, the T-34, which was mass produced, and the US Sherman tank, which was produced. Now the US Sherman tank is a bit of a, you know, technologically the worst that the Europe was going here. This up comes the Sherman tank with flat armour on the side and fuel tanks on either side, so you just basically have to tap it with a artillery piece and it will just completely flame up everyone on the side. The idea of the Sherman tank is that it was a generic model that the US Army ordered from a whole variety of suppliers. And it was bolt-to-bolt compatible with the same Sherman tank, the same Jeep. Everything that the US produced was interchangeable, so they could engage basically with popping an instruction into a coordinated company, USA. And it mightn't be the best, but they can certainly produce a lot of them in different factories. Now, the same is true for this proximity shell, and we'll go very quickly that I think there's over 2,000 US electronics companies which were simultaneously engaged right across the United States to produce it. So it's RCA, basically it's a huge shot in the arm of the fledgling US electronics industry, and you have mass production. So I think it cost roughly per shell, $1,000 US per shell to start off with, and that dropped down to $100 US. Now, back in the day, I think a house would cost about $1,000 or about $2,000, not over $5,000. So, in terms of a shell to fire at it, you could spend your $1,000 a lot of different ways. I don't know what the actual various costs, I think it's a staggering cost, World War II overall. So, for a shell, that's a lot of money, so I'd have to really pay for itself. Now, of course, the vision is that by actually hitting it hard enough with enough money on one area, you could actually mass produce this. I'll be ready in a while. About, give me five minutes. Okay, so sorry, that's my son wanting. I'll take him on a driving lesson in about 5 minutes' time. So it finishes really quickly. Now, the US developed a few other things for it, and this is backlight circuit boards with the printed circuit board, which we virtually don't know nowadays, or it's so sophisticated nowadays that a youth now wouldn't recognise it. But I was in university departments where you could actually put in a print and they could give you a standard circuit board printed out. I think now at the moment you have to buy a circuit board with the copper imprinted on one side, and you have to CNC mill it down. Back then they actually got the printed circuit board to mass produce it. So the US began mass producing these shells, giving it to the British, but selling it back to the British. You can imagine, hopefully they gave him a bit of a discount. But this was a top secret weapon, equal to the secrecy of the atomic bomb. And so it limited its use. You couldn't fire a shell, not explode, because it's a complicated thing, and land in German hands. They take it back, and thank you very much, and they start to work out all the smarts involved in it. But the British were able to use it over British soil and over the channels, and the kill rate went up to 4 in 5 or 8 in 10, and so essentially they quelled the threat of the V1s. So it had an effect in Britain. Then you had the D-Day invasion. I don't think it was used. It was used in support of the D-Day invasion. But the major sort of there was two sort of major turning points in World War II, and one is the famous Battle of the Bulge. So the Americans were caught out by one German division, which was taken off the Eastern Front with the new grade King Tigers and a punch, and essentially a better equipped German army in the right weather conditions should have been able to actually take and brush the Americans aside. And they were going very quickly, and it's called the Battle of the Bulge because it happened up near the Belgium area, and the American Western Front bulged in as these Germans began to go forward. And Patton, the famous US tank general, got the go-ahead to use all these airburst shells. Of course, the airburst, so the shell coupled with the British radar was far more effective against the V1, but it was very effective against open infantry. And this is, so infantry in the open, normally if a shell hits, it hits in the ground and there's a burst at an angle up from where it explodes into the ground, up at an angle. So if you're down, if you lie down, even very close to a shell, it's not going to hurt you. But if the shell bursts, I don't know, 50 metres up in the air, it will have a cone which will actually pepper inside or cover. So infantry in the open are hit by this. Will go, and typically you'd in World War One they'd achieve this by the timing the shell, so the So what would happen is the shell, it would go into the ground and then explode, and then they'd clock it back. An observer would clock it back and try to get an airburst, but this was an airburst every time. And this decimated the German infantry, open infantry with the tanks, and basically turned Battle of the Bulge open. And Patton, observing this, said, well, this has totally changed tactics. And so this is one of the things I think people nowadays still sort of studying World War II tactics or the open tactics, but don't factor in this this thing. There's also standard mortars available by the modern armies have airbursts. So this is a major change in the lethality of all these things, and so it means that you no longer can just dig a little trench and hide in it, because the things bomb from advance on top. So I think this would have been a critical calculation in effect, the ideas of lots of Russian infantry coming into Western Europe. The tanks would have been the major a worry, and the overall thinking is head towards neutron bombs. So with the Americans said, oh, look, this airburst, an airburst of which can get through armor, is something which was very attractive to the Americans. So that if you had the Battle of the Bulge and the Americans not been knocked back, the momentum going forward, a whole lot of other things. But in general, that was the first land use of it. Then we come to the Great Turkey Shoot, as it's called, the Marineris Turkey Shoot, the Philippine Sea, June 44. So this is a full year before the end of World War II. The Americans loaded up all their ships with the new airburst. Around, so you just basically had to point it at the Japanese plane, and you got a horrendous kill rate. Now, there's a few other factors that the Americans had upgraded their planes to be better armed and faster, and so the Zeros had although they're more harder, they're more manoeuvrable. They had to do a lot more shooting to knock down a US plane. They had to stay on the target for a much longer time. So the end result from this one activity, the Japanese were knocked over. They had sort of a rebuild, and so they sort of rebuilt themselves to a formidable air power, just really using their last reserves of men and equipment. And in a very short time, with this airburst artillery, the Americans wiped out 2/3, 75% of the Japanese Air Force. So in terms of, I think this was a week or a couple of days, they just blew the whole lot of them out of the sky. And a lot of... so much so that they blew so many planes away that a lot of the aircraft carriers had nothing to fly on them anymore. So the aircraft carriers would still go along, but they had no planes. This is a full year before the end of the war, so this really broke the back of the Japanese Navy. I think there was one... Oh, yeah, there was another operation, but... it was more trying to draw the US naval attacks away. And of course, the Americans used it quite successfully against the kamikazes. So their effectiveness of the artillery, their anti-aircraft fire, was increased by a factor of 3, by a factor of 10, around that. And this is a dramatic development which changed the course of the war. And then you have the very big showy atomic bomb, which is something that the other powers couldn't have. But this really, really changes the way things operate. Now, of course, nowadays you have heat-seeking missiles. It's a missile effect, but it's still got a long-term impact here. But the end result of it was that it left the U.S. electronics industry, fledgling electronics industry, cashed up with a lot of technology sitting around to mass produce not military goods but consumer goods. So it's important that it moved in two different ways. It sort of really put an end to the sort of Napoleonic era of lining up mass concentration of troops to do things. If you had concentrated troops, it would be just an invitation to airburst over them. So that's really changed it. I don't know whether a modern army training is still quite fully understood the impact of it. And the second aspect is it's changed. It's set America on a course in the right foot to enter the 50s and 60s and 70s and even the modern time now. And now is interesting now that the mass production aspects, the flotation device, it's really interesting to see production lines that's moved over to China. And so it's interesting to see how that's gone. And the moral of the story here is that this is, dare I say, old boring dad topic, old boring thing. World War II is gone. It's a historical angle. I suppose the interesting thing is that the average person is probably not interested in it. But what's more interesting, I suppose, is this revelation of this reasonably obscure technology having a major effect, which really has to be understood or factored in. So it's, I suppose it's the, you have two classes of people, people who know about it, people who don't, and the people who don't have sort of no sense of trying to construct it. They sort of believe in what the propaganda has been fed. And there it is, the propaganda, this was a secret propaganda fed a story, like there's old British war films of a network of spies in France which would look up and send messages to Britain when the aircraft were coming. So the British hid the use of radar, and for a long time this was a hidden technique. And so a lot of people have sort of constructed their view of the past without this here. That was intended for a while for national security, but it is an important thing to understand how this technology is there. And of course, Australia did a lot of operations where we could have really benefited from this technology. It's impossible to go back, but there's this real understanding of getting a feel for where things are going if you have a piece of technology that you understand. This ends this podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. In the meantime, keep on doing and thinking science, or thinking in a sophisticated manner. Thanks for listening.